Every Monday, we have a look at the research that our institutions provide us here through the community to improve our well-being. And our environmental well-being really depends in part on the preservation of waterways. Ken Ashley, the director of the Rivers Institute at BCIT, is an engineer, an instructor in the school's ecological restoration program, and he and his students have been restoring estuaries. We're going to spend some time looking at his work this morning and how important it is in terms of our own well-being in the community. Good morning, Ken. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
Tell me a little bit. Let's break the ice around the water around this one. And what you and your students have been doing in order to try to preserve some of the lost waterway here.
All right. Well, BCIT started an ecological restoration program in 2009. And it was to get beyond the actual protection, but actually start restoring ecosystems that had been degraded over time. And the program, it's a two-year degree. You get a Bachelor of Science in Ecological Restoration. And it teaches all the, very much like an emergency room physician. It takes, if you imagine somebody rolling into the ER in bad shape from a car accident or something like that.
Is it like that? I mean, is that the same sort of urgency to it?
Oh, yes. I tell the students if they don't like the sight of degraded ecosystems that they're in the wrong business. So it's like in an ER physician, if you don't like the sight of blood, you're not going to do very well in that type of job. So some of the environments that they get to look at, you know, those that study pristine environments that go hiking up into wilderness areas and do research on those type of environments, that's really great because they're in pristine condition and you're learning how ecosystems function. But when you're doing ecosystem restoration, sometimes the patients are in less than perfect shape when you get to see them. And so that was the case around Burrard Inlet here.
Yeah.
And it was kind of ironic what happened, that there was an oil spill in 2007 that you may recall, that unfortunate contractor punched a line, right? Yes,
yeah.
And that oil flowed down into Burrard Inlet. It was around 234,000 liters. And that ended up going to court, and the three companies were charged, or three entities were charged for it. And in BC, there's an interesting provision called creative sentencing, where that money was sent to the Habitat Conservation Trust Foundation, which is an NGO in BC.
Mm-hmm.
And they have this provision that provincial funds for environmental offenses can be sent to them. So they ended up inheriting around $460,000. And then that money then became available to start doing ecological restoration work in Burrard Inlet. And so that was sort of the idea point that I had, that I went to their program head at BCIT and said, you know, there's some money available to do work around Burrard Inlet, and we've got students that were teaching ecological restoration, and Burrard Inlet certainly needs it, and that's where the nexus of the idea came from.
When you say that that you know you're stumbling upon this as someone in an ER would in terms of almost triage of some sort, what did you encounter there?
Well, we looked at went out to UBC Geography Library, and they have aerial photographs of the Burrard Inlet and Greater Vancouver area going back to the earliest we could get was 1926. And that's not bad, realizing that Wright brothers didn't get off the ground in 1903. So by 1926 already, people were hanging out the side of planes and taking pictures as the cities were developing here. And what it showed is how amazing the landscape was around Burrard Inlet in the 1920s. Even then, you could see the amount of impacts, the logging, of course. We know with Cassie Jack's saloon here just down the road that this area was clear cut in the sort of 1870s, 1880s, those famous old pictures of Vancouver with houses beside big smoldering stumps. And a lot of the large wood that came out of here. And the upland impacts were essentially just logging, but the foreshore was starting being developed early on, and lots of wood booms being stored in here, sawmills and things like that. So the habitat impacts went back at least a century. And now, of course, you look around Burrard Inlet, and the inlet is a major, you know, it's Canada's biggest port. There's a lot of infrastructure, and a lot of the natural environment has been lost.
Ken Ashley is my guest. He is the director of the Rivers Institute at BCIT, and we're talking about the restoration, because it really is restoration, right?
That's correct.
With our estuaries. When you see it now, do you develop an opinion about the balance that takes place in Burrard Inlet around the fact that we are a port city, and yet we are really endeavoring to the greatest degree possible to have as pristine as possible as possible, an environmental condition. Do you form an opinion on what has to be the direction there?
Well, that's a delicate balance that all levels of government has to achieve, you know, that's really reflective of societal values. So you have municipal governments and then the regional government and then the provincial and federal government. And, you know, depending on who's in power in various places, that can swing back and forth over time. As we knew, we just had a recent election. And I think the general public want to see a vibrant economy, and most people want to see an intact environment. And I think that was pretty loud and clear in the
last. Can you have both?
If it's done right, you can. And that's what you've heard about, this wind-up of everybody's going to Paris and going to essentially come up with a global climate pact for the whole planet. And I think that's reflective of most of the countries of the world. And if you listen to Obama or Prime Minister Trudeau, they're talking about how it's time to get serious about climate change. So what's that? What everybody's saying there is that the environment and the economy are essentially one and the same.
You instruct students. You've probably seen a generational shift in attitudes and all that. What do you think your students want for their future? Are they making it really clear?
Oh, absolutely. The students I see now very much remind me of what people were like in the 1960s.
Yeah, the idealists.
They're very idealistic. It seems, you know, and I'm old enough to sort of, that's why I got into what I'm doing in environment, because of the 60s. I never gave it up. Whereas, you remember what happened in the 1960s or 70s and 1980s, and, you know, 1980s typified by that movie with Michael Douglas, you know, Wall Street, where he says greed is good. things kind of went off the rails then, and it really wasn't until, I think, Al Gore came along and the Inconvenient Truth, and you started hearing about, you know, what this essentially is doing to the planet. And so the students you see now, when you talk about, you always hear about climate change is going to do this in 2040 and this in 2050, and it's abstract to a lot of people, but this is essentially going to be their entire working lives, and they're going to wear it. And so there's a bit of fear in their eyes as these increased climate disasters that are happening, whether it's Hurricane Katrina or Sandy or the flooding or the type of forest fires summer we just had. So they're into it because they like it, but they realize that this isn't abstract, that this is going to be their entire career that they're going to be involved with. And so it's going to be pretty exciting times, but there's a little bit of nervousness about how crazy the climate's going to get.
Yeah. How do you see them approaching this in general? Is it, are they approaching it from a scientific perspective, an economic perspective, a political perspective? Which one weighs more in your work?
Well, I asked them at the start of each class, I say, why are you here? Like, why aren't you in accounting or medicine or, you know, why are you sitting here? I said, if you're expecting to get rich, you're in the wrong class and you should just pack up and go right now. But, you know, about a third of the class said they saw something on TV, either Jacques Cousteau's reruns or, strangely enough, Mutual of Omaha, Marlon Perkins.
Marlon Perkins.
Yeah. I mean, I can't believe the influence that guy had.
They see that.
Well, they must have been reruns. I don't know, but that was mentioned. Often an uncle or grandfather took them fishing or something like that.
Yeah.
And so it was just an inherent appreciation environment and a love of being outside. And of course, in BC, how can you not appreciate that? But then realizing that they wanted to sort of be on the front line of making sure that wasn't lost. And so it was both just a childhood appreciation for it, but then wanted to make sure that wasn't lost. And so they wanted to essentially learn the professional skills rather than just being a layperson.
In your own case, Ken, I mean, you're now the director of a really well-respected institute that has to deal with it. But was there one episode in your life that directed you to this work?
I guess in my case, it was the same. I used to watch Mutual Omaha. I hate to admit it, but I love watching that Wild Kingdom. And of course, that was not the Jacques Cousteau reruns. That was the real Jacques Cousteau in the mid 1960s. And my dad used to be a part-time commercial fisherman, and he actually had a fish boat under Gravel Street Bridge back then, and actually went out and made a partial living fishing for salmon in English Bay in a troller. And so my job on Saturdays and Sundays was to steer the boat around and watch the fish and hear these stories about how many more there used to be. And, so developed the appreciation at an early age for the environment.
We're going to take a small break now with Ken Ashley, who's the director of the Rivers Institute at BCIT. We're going to come back and we're going to talk specifically about some of the research, some of the activity that you and your students are undertaking in order to restore our estuaries. I'm Kirk LaPointe. You're listening to Our City. I'll be back in a moment.
At Roundhouse, we believe in the strength of community. That's why Roundhouse Radio will make a donation to a local nonprofit for every person who registers at roundhouseradio.com. So email your friends and pay it forward. The more people who register, the larger the donation. Together, we can make Vancouver stronger.
Thanks. Thank you, Roundhouse.
Roundhouseradio.com.
Nearly 7:49 now here at Roundhouse Radio. You're listening to Our City. My name's Kirk LaPointe. I'll be with you until 9 o'clock this morning. Every Monday, we have a look at some of the research that our institutions are conducting to improve our well-being. And today, I'm talking to Ken Ashley. He's the director of the Rivers Institute at BCIT, and he's an engineer and instructor in the school's ecological restoration program. His students and he have been restoring estuaries, and we've been talking a little bit about some of the broader issues, but I want to get right down to the actual research and then the effort that you make, Ken, with it. It sounds like tremendously heavy lifting, that this is not a matter of a few people on a beach with some hoses. How do you undertake a project like this, and what are you learning?
Yeah, it's pretty intense, because everybody's seen research scientists out working and they're on a beach somewhere with some tweezers collecting something, and this is the opposite. And I teach the students, these estuaries were changed with a huge amount of force, and it takes an equal amount of force to put them back together. So the first thing we do is generally go in and find out who owns the land, if we can even set foot on it, because a lot of the tidal areas they're industrial sites 100 years old, and they may have one, two, or five ownership, and you have to find out if you can access the site. And then the next thing, if we find we can get on it, is just to take some samples and find out if it's contaminated. Because if it's a contaminated site, then it's a whole different ballgame. If it turns out it's some crown land that we can access and it's not contaminated, then we start to lay out a restoration plan. And the first part is very coarse scale, where you bring in large excavators, possibly bulldozers, backhoes, and you do the physical reshaping to sort of push it back into its normal shape, because it was usually pushed out of shape in order to make access for barges or tugs or waterfront loading. And that's the first core scale. And in that process, there's invariably some invasive plants are growing down there. Blackberries or Japanese knotweed or hogweed, all these sort of invasive plants that are showing up. So in that initial recontouring, the invasive plants are removed. And then basically it's almost like you've got a bare foundation for a house. You've got it the right shape. The land's leveled or sloping, however it's supposed to be. And we use a nearby reference site so that we know put it back to what it used to. And then it goes into the next stage, which is bringing in habitat back in there, boulders and logs, and put those back and look in the right place. And then it gets replanted with the native vegetation. And then at that point, you really sort of just take a break and let the vegetation come back. And you get this interesting sort of infill of organisms that are around. They start flying by or swimming by and saying, oh, this looks like a decent place to live again. And so it starts to, the animals start to come back on their own.
Does it take you 3, 4, 5 years in a lot of ways for you to start to see a little bit of the result?
There's about a year's worth of planning to find out if you can actually get in there. But once the physical habitat's in, it's amazing how quickly things happen. Like over on the North Shore, on McKay Creek, for example, there was an old low-head dam there that prevented salmon from getting above the dam and getting up McKay Creek. And the seals would come in and they would herd the salmon and get them up against the wall, essentially, and just slaughter them.
Exactly.
It was kind of sad watching. It was like shooting ducks in a barrel. And when the dam was removed, and it had been in there for 50 years, when it was removed, I mean, the fish were in there the next day and going up the stream, and the seals were sort of sitting there with a disappointed look on their face because they couldn't chase them anymore.
Where are they now?
Yeah, you've just ruined our lunch. And so that, you see a very quick response on that. And as the vegetation grows back, on that particular site, it was done in 2013, so it had the summer of fall of 2013, 14, 15, and now you go and look at it, and it's tough to tell that it ever was in a degraded state. And then you get all the birds and some of the small mammals. There's even a group, several beavers living in there now, in the middle of the city.
Is there enough work for a lifetime at Burrard in it?
There's a lot of work. I don't know about a lifetime. I mean, that's 80 years. But I think for a group of people, it's been about 100 years to put it to where it is right now. And so it's going to take, at least, you know, a significant fraction of that to put back what can be brought back. Obviously, there's a lot industrialized, and that's going to stay that way. It's Canada's biggest port, but there's a lot of habitat area that can be restored, certainly over around Maplewood Flats. There's a lot of old derelict creosote pilings in there that you drive over the Second Narrows Bridge, you see these pilings sort of out in the middle of nothing's going on with those things. And they have creosote in them, which is a carcinogen, and it's leaching out, and herring can't spawn on them. So there's a lot of low-hanging fruit things that can be done. And the Tsleil-Waututh First Nations has developed a plan with Port Metro Vancouver to remove those pilings.
Were you frustrated when you first started in this work to see what had been left alone, what had been left to degrade for all this time?
In a way, because I don't think in the 19... Well, you just have to look at the pictures of North Vancouver in the 1940s. I mean, it was the shipyards over there. It was a war effort, and you know, dealing with Adolf Hitler was a higher priority of building our maritime fleet with to get goods over to England and into Europe. So, you know, at that point in time, there was no real concern about the environment because there was so much of it left, and there was always another stand of trees over the next hill, and so environmental thinking really didn't emerge until the mid 1963 when Rachel Carson's Silent Spring broke out. Most people, yes. You know, even though they talk about John Muir and the Sierra Club and
her book was the turner.
Yeah, that was sort of the turning point, and that's what the 60s is all about. But then, as we mentioned earlier, the 60s kind of stalled in the 70s and 80s and 90s, and then Al Gore, if anybody, you know, sort of rechanneled what Rachel Carson had started, and basically that's where we find ourselves now in the 21st century. And rather than pesticides, which is what Rachel Carson was all about, and DDT, and the new emerging chemicals that came after World War II, then it was climate change now.
Do you see a particular Vancouver or British Columbian outlook that you think is quite different than the rest of Canada's, the rest of even North America's?
Absolutely. I mean, BC and Vancouver is the environmental sort of nexus of North America. I mean, Greenpeace started here. I remember very clearly in grade 12 when the atomic bomb testing was going on up in Amchitka, and it was the Don't Make a Wave Committee with the Phyllis Cormack to go up there. And so, you know, Greenpeace started here. I mean, Terry Fox was from here. I mean, there's BC still has the most intact large tracts of land and large carnivores like grizzly bears, eagles. I mean, Southeast Alaska and BC is really the last stand in North America for intact functioning ecosystems. And so it's not abstract for people to appreciate what the environment is. And so it makes sense with the whales off the coast, the salmon we have coming back in here, that the environmental ethic is stronger here than anywhere else. And you know, it's radiating out across Canada, and I'm sure in the Maritimes, and they realize with the collapse of the cod fishery that they might have done things differently there.
In the last minute, as a result of the election, do you think there's much more optimism now about the way in which a senior level of government is going to examine these issues?
Oh, hugely. I mean, the changes you've seen already, that the federal government sent out information to their fishery scientists saying they're free to talk to the press now about anything, and the sort of the whole unmuzzling.
Hard to believe you can actually talk to a scientist again.
That's right. They're allowed to talk, and the fact that Canada's going to the climate change talks in Paris with all the provincial ministers and Elizabeth May, and so yeah, it's a huge relief and a fantastic step in the right direction.
Well, I hope you'll be a regular resource for us here at the station, Ken.
I'd love to come in and keep you updated, Kirk, and it'd be even more interesting to get some of the students in there and have a chat with them.
Yeah, great to have you. Great to have you in the community. Ken Ashley is the director of the Rivers Institute at BCIT, talking a little bit about his research, but largely about his outlook, and it's great. Congratulations on all of that.